Let's go ahead and begin our Bible study. We are going to examine the question, what does the Bible teach about Christians and indebtedness? After the introductory material, this is going to be a scripture-based lesson, and I'll explain why there are so many texts in just a moment. America is a debtor nation, and there is no question about that. I would say that this is the case more so than any other nation in the world. And while other nations have more difficulty in paying their bills and their debts than we do, our debt is, it's just simply unbelievable when measured against the rest of the world. Our national debt is $29 trillion. Now, we're talking about real money here, aren't we? It's starting to get a little bit high. $29 trillion. I remember naively back about 30-some years ago when I was subscribing to U.S. News and World Report that I opened up an issue of it and saw that the national debt was $4 billion. And I tossed the magazine down and said, this country's circling the drain. Well, here we are 30 years later, and it would be nice to have a $4 trillion national debt, wouldn't it, by comparison? What this breaks down to is, for every U.S. citizen, that's $86,200 per citizen, but not every U.S. citizen pays taxes. So for every U.S. taxpayer, the obligation of the national debt comes to over $200,000, $228,400 per taxpayer. This is simply not something that we as American taxpayers will be able to pay in our lifetime. Now, we can't fix the national debt. It's just, it's not something that we as individual citizens can do. This is more relevant to our study this evening. The average American's personal debt is $52,940. Now, that was as of a few days ago. That fluctuates as well. But this debt includes a breakdown of mortgages, home equity loans, car loans, student loans, personal loans, and credit card debt. Of these, the biggest number, obviously, is going to be mortgages. The second largest number will be student loans. It might surprise you that the amount owed in student loans exceeds the amount owed by, in terms of credit card debt or personal loans or things of that nature. But at any rate, this is the average American's personal debt. So for some folks, it's much more. With others, it's considerably less. But this means that every person in this country, we have as personal debt. This is not national debt. This is not something that our government's going to pay. This is something that we as individuals owe, is around $53,000. That's significant. What creates much of the problem experienced by individuals in the country in terms of debt is that there are more than 600 million credit cards held by Americans. Now, when you divide that by the population, that's two credit cards for every man, woman, and child in this country. That's far more than is necessary. Last year, credit card debt grew by almost $100 billion. Now, that's credit card debt. Now, it still doesn't approach student loan or things of that nature, but it is a significant amount. And what makes it so difficult is that the interest rates on credit card debt are considerably higher than what they are, say, for a mortgage or an auto loan or even subsidized student loans and things of that nature. What this means for folks is that we are all buried under the awareness of debt. Whether it's an individual is free of personal debt, there's still the awareness of national debt. But for most folks, debt is one of the most discouraging things that we'll encounter on this earth. It robs us of a great deal of good experiences in life. It robs us of capabilities, and it takes away, in many cases, good family relationships. Debt is the second most common reason given for divorce in this country. The second most common. Many Christians don't seem to understand debt very well, and the world doesn't appear to understand it at all. Just quickly, let me go through some symptoms of financial bondage. If these things are true, a few of these are true about us, then we realize that we've got more debt than what we perhaps should. If someone is charging the necessities of life, I mean charging on credit cards for food, clothing, and gasoline, and only paying on it on a monthly basis without paying the whole thing, that's too much debt. If they're borrowing money to pay fixed expenses like utilities and rent, if creditors are calling or writing or constantly sending some sort of message asking for their money, we're in too much debt. If we find ourselves tempted to be dishonest in some way about money, and there are many ways in which one can be, then we've too much. Unable to contribute at church or to help in community causes. If we find ourselves unable to do these things, we've too much debt. If we find ourselves frequently in arguments with our spouse or fussing with our family about money, there's too much debt. If we're unaware of how much we owe, that's a problem. This is something that people should be very much aware of and do some serious budgeting, especially when times become financially difficult. If we're uncertain about how much it takes to survive each week, we're going to either be in debt or we won't be long until we are. These are indicators. Now, here's where we have to understand that the Word speaks to this matter. We've got to have this written down somewhere, and I don't mean with pen and ink. Get a hammer, a chisel, and a stone and write it down. Because this is important. Spending choices come from spiritual decisions. And this is a fact. When we conclude our study this evening, what we'll realize is that the decisions we make with regard to our spending in this life have spiritual implications. They result from our spiritual thinking, who we are spiritually, and what we've decided to be as children of God. Let me give you an illustration of this. Philippians chapter 4, beginning at verse 11. The Apostle Paul writes here with regard to his own condition. And please understand, this is one of Paul's prison epistles, so his means are going to be very limited. In fact, he'll find himself quite dependent upon others for his well-being. The church at Philippi, for example, was one who sent to his assistance while he was unable to go anywhere. House arrest, I think, was the case. He says, not that I speak in regard to need, for I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. Two things are said in this passage, that Paul cultivated contentment regardless of his condition, and that implies that we can be content in life regardless of our financial condition. We can find a measure of contentment and a means of bearing with whatever a day may bring. And the second thing is that it's a process. Paul had to purposely cultivate this mindset. He learned to do this, which indicates that it was a process whereby he came to this understanding and maintained it. And then he says, I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. I know how to, everywhere and in all things, I've learned. Here's that term again that indicates that for him it was a process that he had to deliberately choose. I've learned to be both full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So Paul has understood how to bear with hard times and how to bear with prosperous times and to be content in either case. It was a spiritual choice on his part to learn this. And therefore, when times were difficult, he could bear with it and he would make decisions accordingly because he made the spiritual choice to learn contentment. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And this speaks to his understanding that he will be depending upon the providence of the Lord and the kindness of others in difficult times. and will acknowledge his obligation to the Lord and his obligation to others when he is in prosperity. So Paul realizes that with the help of the Lord, he is in either case prospering or suffering want, and that he can bear with it. If the Lord wills that he is in that condition, he will learn to find spiritual contentment. The Bible addresses this matter at great length. But when was the last time that this was something that folks studied in their homes with their families in their home Bible studies? Or when was the last time that we saw this matter taught on in Bible classes or in sermons? So what we conclude is that what we learn as Christians about debt and its management comes from our culture. It doesn't come from the spiritual decisions that we need to be informed about. And our culture encourages debt. More about that a little bit later. Now, this is one of the things that I wish our civil government understood. We cannot borrow our way into prosperity. That's simply not going to happen. What we often overlook is the fact that the Bible talks more about money than it does faith and prayer combined. And it doesn't talk about money because God cares about money. It talks about money because we care about money. And we need to be informed and taught in these things so that we understand better how to use the gifts that we have been given. And the way that we feel about money is a product of our faith. Steve, if you would, read for me Luke, the 12th chapter, verses 13 to 15. And while he's looking for that passage, I want to observe this, that Jesus is teaching, and his message is interrupted by someone who is quite materialistic. And Jesus makes an example of this fellow and talks about his interest in material things. So Luke 12, 13 to 15, please.
Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me to be a judge or arbitrator over you?" Then he said to them, Beware and be on your spiritual guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions."
Thank you. And in this reading, what you see is someone who, rather than paying attention to Christ's spiritual instruction in the first several verses of that chapter, he's waiting for an opportunity to interrupt Jesus and say, "You tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me properly." And, you know, Jesus says, "I didn't come here to be a judge. I didn't come here to be the mediator for you in a material way. That's not what I'm doing. That's not what I have an interest in doing. I'm not appointed to that." And then he turns to the crowd, and he's obviously not apologetic to this fellow for having rebuked him. He turns to this crowd and tells them to beware of greed. It's something that can attack human beings. Be very aware of this. For one's life, that is, our existence in this world, is not made up of the things that we own. Now, one of the things that we must clearly understand is that, especially when we see what Paul has to say to Timothy about this in the latter part of his first epistle, is that the poor man can be as afflicted with greed as the wealthy man. We tend to think that this greed issue is reserved for those who are affluent, and this is not true. In fact, you will often find that the poor themselves are envious of the wealthy and wish that they had the same means. And so, how we feel about money is a product of our faith. This fellow wasn't listening to Jesus teach. He was interested in material goods. And Jesus rebukes him and tells him that's not what life is all about. Life is not about these things. And so, the two points that we have made so far need to be remembered through the balance of this study. obviously this one, that the way we feel about money is a product of our faith, and the other one is that our financial choices are based upon spiritual decisions. Now let's ask what is written. I have a bunch of texts to consider, and I don't think we'll read all of them, but we'll look at a select few just to reinforce the point. And basically what I did was go through the scriptures and find the places where you find at least financial things talked about in scripture, at least in terms of instruction for those who are God's people. And the first one that I come to is that debt is a form of slavery. And Solomon in his wisdom speaks to this. He says in Proverbs 22:7, the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is a servant to the lender. Then he goes on to explain to use caution when it comes to giving a pledge, or in this particular case, taking on a debt and offering collateral. He says that if you should have nothing to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? Which means that the one to which he has contracted a debt owns the things that are collateral and therefore can take them if the debt is not paid. This is even seen more clearly the next point, that debt prevents peaceful rest. I want you to consider the condition that the people are in Nehemiah 5:3-5. And Sandy, if you would, read that, please. But listen to the plight of these folks as she reads it. Nehemiah 5:3-5.
There were others who said, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses, that we might get grain because of the famine." Also, there were those who said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters are forced into bondage already. And we are helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others."
These folks are in dire straits. It's a difficult situation. Nehemiah has helped. He's come from the east in his servitude to the king over the empire, the Medo-Persian king. He's come from the east and went to Jerusalem to help with the restoration of the walls and the restoring of the city. And one of the things that he discovers when he gets to the city is that their finances are fully depleted, that most of the folks cannot afford to buy food. There's been a famine in the land. And on top of that, the Medo-Persian king is expecting his tribute. He wants his money. Doesn't matter whether there's a famine, you pay me your taxes or your tribute. So here you have these people who have not been able to raise a crop and make a profit from it. There is a famine and they can't afford to buy food. And the king is demanding his tax money. It is what we would consider an impossible situation. And so what they've done is they've gone to their fellow Jews and borrowed money from them and given their own family as security for this loan. And their family is being destroyed by this. What we see taking place is that our children are being taken by the ones to whom we've made these loans and turned into servants and slaves. It's a terrible situation. They found themselves in that condition. Now, while sometimes circumstances are difficult, and circumstances can take away prosperity and impose hardship on us, these were folks who were concerned about their means and their well-being to the extent that they entered into and engaged into an arrangement that was going to make them sleepless, that was going to destroy their family, that was going to consume their lives. Debt can do that kind of thing. Scriptures tell us that debt is the temporary lazy path to revenue. In Ecclesiastes 5:4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. He has no pleasure in fools. We are not supposed to be casual in the incurring of debt in order to accomplish any purposes. In Proverbs 6, 10 through 11, he says, a little sleep, a little slumber. He's talking about the lazy person, and he finds himself in want. Now, I would suggest to you that it was the famine and the Medo-Persian king that made the children of Judah in want, but they still engaged foolishly into an arrangement. In Proverbs 21, 5 and 20, the plans of the diligent surely lead to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty surely to poverty. There is a desirable treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but the foolish man squanders it. And so what we learn is that debt becomes the lazy person's solution to being in want. And it's not always the answer. In fact, it's seldom the answer. Debt is God's metaphor for sin. Now, this does not mean that debt is sin, but God uses it as a metaphor. In the book of Amos, he talks about in the second chapter about how that those who were the moneylenders were going and soliciting debts from others, and then they would take away their goods and stuff, and they'd put on the very clothes that they took from others and go in and kneel before the altar. God says, that's an abomination. And he talked about the sin that they engaged in. In Matthew 18, Jesus again uses it as a metaphor for forgiveness in the 18th chapter. In Romans 6, 16 to 23, our debt in that context is sin, and Christ is the one who pays for our debt of sin. So God uses it as a metaphor for sin. Debt compromises our ability to provide. In Proverbs 13, 22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. In 22 and 3, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. They have to bear with the consequences of not looking to the future. Debt reduces our ability to be generous. I want you to notice, not only in the wisdom of the Old Testament, but in Jesus' teaching as well. In Proverbs 3, 9 and 27, honor the Lord with your possession, with the first fruit of your increase. Do not withhold good from those to whom it's due when it is in the power of your hand to do so. And this is a principle that we see taught by the Lord and by the apostles in the New Testament. When we engage so much debt that we cannot aid those who are in need, we have engaged too much debt. And we have reduced our ability to serve the Lord in this matter. In 1 John 3 and 17, but whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? In this particular case, he cannot say, well, there's a clause in between the lines there that say that if you've gotten into too much debt because you can't afford to pay for your boat and motor that you bought, then you don't need to help your brother who is in need. That's not in there. Jesus said, give to him who asks you, Turn and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Now, the primary reason why I use this passage is this, that Jesus is teaching us that we lend to those who are in need. What is he saying here? If the act of borrowing is a sin, Jesus would be advocating our complicity with the sins of others by lending to them. And this is one of the ways in which we can know that an honorable debt is not a sin. It is only sinful when we refuse to repay the debt. And there are multiple other things that are said in Scripture. Debt conflicts with a hardworking mindset. Debt is more than a number. It is a way of thinking. And you can see all through the Scriptures that this is what is spoken to. That debt interferes with the work. In fact, those who are inclined to be indebted as a means of generating revenue are persons who are using this in place of labor to supply their needs. But you can see that in all of these cases, the Lord is encouraging diligence and hard work as opposed to borrowing in order to pay for the things that we need. Going into debt for material desires erodes spiritual life. I could spend the rest of the night talking about this. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. There is no amount of satisfying the hunger in one who loves money. And it's foolish for one to try to engage, to satisfy this desire with money that is borrowed, especially. Mark 4 and 12, the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the desires for other things entering in choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. How many times do we read this parable and think that it's the owning of things and stuff that chokes out the word? Look again at what Jesus says there in the third part of his list. He didn't say that the deceitfulness of riches and the cares of this world were the only thing that choke it out. He said the desires for other things entering in choke the word. How many persons have gone into serious levels of debt in order to get the things and the stuff that they want? In 1 Timothy 6 and 10, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Our conduct needs to be without covetousness, and where our treasure is, our heart is. How foolish it is to engage and satisfy the desire of materialism within us by incurring debt to fulfill that. The scriptures tell us that it is wrong not to repay our debts. The psalmist writes in 37 and 21, the wicked borrows and does not repay, but the righteous shows mercy and give. It is not necessarily a sin to incur debt, but it is a sin to refuse to pay it. We learn in the New Testament that one cannot serve God and material desires. Jesus said no one can serve two masters. It's not going to be possible to stay focused on our material interests and our means of supplying them and yet remain faithful to the Lord at the same time. Especially true when we are wallowing in debt. It consumes our thought. It erodes our influence. And it ultimately reduces the quality of our life in this world. So we end up so focused on these things that we're unable to stay focused on spiritual matters. We're also taught in the scriptures not to make financial decisions driven by fear. In the parable that the Lord tells of the three servants commissioned by the master to use his goods to increase, the one talent servant said the following, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. You see, he made a financial decision based upon fear. And in some cases, this is what motivates people to incur debt. Now, in many cases, it's by greed. But even if one is afraid, incurring debt under fear is a poor financial decision. You see the case of the people in Nehemiah's day who did just that, and they ruined their family life. We are told that we need to acknowledge our true source of blessings. In 2 Corinthians 9 and 10, listen to what Paul says with regard to the source of the blessings. Now, may he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. And this tells us that whatever we have, however much or however little it is, that when we use it in service to the Lord, he increases it, kind of like Jesus took the lad's lunch and fed a multitude. Yes.
This passage and many other of these passages you brought out are something I consider spiritual economics. How do we go from the material money into spiritual money? And this is one of those passages where it comes right out and says, he will bless you if you're doing his will and helping others and doing that. That is lay up for yourself spiritual treasure in heaven. This is a part of how you do that. And there's so many good passages that are brought out about spiritual economics.
And I should have consulted you before I wrote this lesson. We could subtitle it spiritual economics. But anyway, and that's what I was trying to emphasize at the beginning. That's the statement, that financial choices are driven by spiritual decisions. When we are spiritually minded persons, our financial choices are going to reflect our spiritual decisions. And so each of these actually is teaching us to get our spirit in the right place, and this interaction that we have with the world around us will follow. God's the one who supplies our finances. You know, we consider our jobs to be the source of our finances, but that's really not the case. God is the one who has blessed us, which is what we say every week when we talk about the offering, as the Lord has prospered us. In Matthew 6 and 26, Jesus says, "Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they?" And so what we need to do is develop the confidence and not be moved by fear, certainly not be moved by greed, to incur debt in order to resolve the issue. God is the one who is the source. We are to maintain a generous spirit. Now, one might say, well, I'm quite limited in how generous I can be. So was the widow who cast in two mites. You know, there is something that we all can do, and we need to be working toward the place where we can accomplish these things. In Proverbs 28 and 27, "He who gives to the poor will not lack, but he who hides his eyes will have many curses." I'm not able to help you, so I'm not seeing that you have this need. We should not be in a position like that. And then work with what you have. And that's also a Bible principle, New Testament and Old Testament alike. But primarily in the New Testament, "Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law." And this speaks to that spiritual thing. Once we get our spiritual life in the right place, our relationship and interaction with others in all things, including the matter of debt, will follow. In Luke 19 and 17, he said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant, because you were faithful in very little, have authority over 10 cities." And yes, I stole that from you, Steve. But at any rate, what this speaks to is that when we demonstrate in our lives that we can care for these issues, these financial issues, then we prove that we are qualified in the eyes of the divine to handle more serious matters. Now, this is what the Word has to say. What would be a good plan developed from the Word itself for a debt-free life? I would say begin with a written plan. Write it down. When times are difficult, I think we're more sensitive to this and we're more inclined to do so. But even in times of prosperity, create an itemized list of all the expenses and put them in the order of importance. At the top of the list will be what we give to the divine. What will continue to follow is what we are obligated to render in order to maintain life in this world. Our obligation to civil government that is spoken of in Romans 13. All of these things are biblical precedents, and these are to be addressed first. These are the important ones. We make a list of our needs, our wants, and our desires, and keep them separate. Learn to distinguish among them. Needs are life's basic necessities. Things like food and clothing and employment, a home, medical coverage. These are all things that are the necessities of life, and these need to be addressed first. These are things that are spoken to in one form or another in Scripture. Wants are choices about the quality of the goods that we consume. You know, we say to ourselves, well, having food and clothing, with these will be content. It doesn't say having caviar and Versace, with these we will be content. And my point is this, that we need to realize that there is a difference between needing clothing and wanting fine clothing. And that's where we make the distinction. Dress clothes versus work clothes, steak versus hamburger, new car versus used car. Yes, I know hamburger is approaching the cost of steak right now. Desires are those goods and services we choose. that are not essential to our survival, not important to our safety or our well-being. These are the differences. Needs are first. Desires or wants will always be second and subject to fulfilling all of the first. And desires will be third and maybe a distant third. So this is where we find ourselves. Make a plan. Now, the second thing would be determine the essentials for living. Even among those things that are essential for life, there is a possibility that we can find ways to adjust these, eliminate unnecessary living expenditures, and look for services that can be done without outside cost. Here are just a few things, and the list is quite long. These are things that I've kind of had to learn over the years, and I'm sure you have as well. Consider purchasing essentials from a consignment shop or a thrift store. Repair or refinish furniture and cars instead of instantly buying the new one. Learn to do your own home repairs where possible. You might find that to be quite a fulfilling experience. Now today, I was telling Jill about it earlier, was a frustrating experience. But it's not always that way. But when you find something that you have and you realize, oh no, this is breaking down and the repairs bill is going to be expensive, do it. Take a little bit of time, figure it out, and try to do it yourself. I would suggest that when it comes to electricity, you think twice. But instead, you know, shop for groceries at a discount market. Go to Aldi's instead of going to Publix or someplace like that. Learn to cook at home instead of going out to restaurants. Grow a garden. Right, Steve? I think you may discover that one really doesn't pay for itself either. Cultivate marketable hobbies. You know, these are all ways in which we can do those things that are necessary to living in quality of life. And yet we challenge ourselves, even if we have the means and are not in debt, we challenge ourselves to where we find ourselves more capable of using the blessings that we have for spiritual purposes. Third, think before buying. Think it through, especially if our families are in debt. Evaluate every purchase. Is it a Proverbs 24 and 3, Solomon says, by knowledge the rooms are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. And what he's telling us here in proverbial form is that it's by thinking and reasoning, it's by using what we know, it's by being wise, and that's how one finds themselves, in most cases, moving toward prosperity. So one of the questions we should ask is it a necessity? These other things. Have I assessed whether it is a need, a want, or a desire? Does the purchase reflect my Christian ethics? Can I continue to engage my desires while I owe others? And the answer to that is no. Is this the best possible buy I can get, or am I purchasing it only because I have a credit card? I have a credit card and the limit is high and I like this thing, so I'm going to buy it. That's not good reasoning. That's not thinking it through. Is it a highly depreciative item? You know, am I buying something that's going to devalue quickly and need to be replaced? Is it costly to keep it up? Now, these things we ought to be asking ourselves with regard to them. And what we'll learn from this is that when we choose to handle our finances God's way and consistently practice it, we'll find ourselves cared for, whether as we are, as Paul said, in want or in abundance. Either way, we realize that we are cared for. The question becomes at this point, do we trust Him enough to believe and to act on His instruction in these things? And this is what Jesus says with regard to this, to seek first the kingdom of God. This is the spiritual first. And then pursue, we'll discover that the material needs will follow, that God will be caring for His own. In Philippians 4 and 19, again, Paul writing from one of his prison epistles, my God shall supply all your need according to His riches in glory by Christ Jesus. I like what Hudson Taylor wrote about this and with regard to persons trusting God for what they need to accomplish God's will. God's work, done God's way, will not lack God's support. Rather simple, but it is very, very accurate and direct. What else do we do? Well, we spend less than what we earn. Remember, spending choices come from spiritual decisions. We must make this decision and work every day in order to make it happen. And find ways in which we can spend less than what we earn. This principle is essential to financial strength. And the reason why many people go into debt, they develop a lifestyle and realize that they're not bringing in enough to continue to maintain that lifestyle, so they're at a crossroads. They can either eliminate the things in their lifestyle that are a financial strain but not necessary, or they can continue to go into debt in order to maintain that lifestyle. The alternatives is to spend only what we earn, and thus we're living hand to mouth, or we spend more than what we earn and we go into debt. The problem is not in earning it, but managing it. Again, spending choices come from spiritual decisions. And one who is not spiritually minded is the kind of person who says, okay, this much belongs to the Lord and the rest of it I can do with what I want. What we need to understand is that it all comes from God and that it all belongs to Him. And that we are merely stewards of it. And so we need to be willing to change our behavior and spend less than what we earn. We also need to become content with what we have. Like Paul said, and we read this earlier in the class. So someone says, how do I learn to live contentedly without becoming complacent or without becoming discontent? And it's not a difficult process. Paul said that he learned contentment. So I would suggest that we begin by learning gratitude. I've told the story before here, I know. I tell it everywhere that I work and use it in invitations. When I was in Youngstown preaching, I went to Warren to the projects and had Bible classes there for quite some time. And there was this quite aged African-American woman who had a very thin, high, reedy voice that was always at the class. And I was challenging the class to realize that everything comes from God and that they need to be thankful to Him for it. And so I asked the question, and you know how pompous us preachers can be, be quiet, Max. That I asked the question, what if the U.S. government and the state of Ohio were to come in and take away the very place that you live, and the only thing you had left in this world was the space you were standing at in the parking lot? What would you do? And I waited for, gave one of those significant preacher pauses. And into that silence, this high, thin, reedy voice said, thank you for the space, Lord. That's the right answer. And the hair still stands up on my arm whenever I think about that woman. Learn gratitude. Here was somebody who had nothing except to live in the projects in Warren. And she was grateful. Thank you for the space, Lord. Learn gratitude. Rejoice with others when they are blessed. It will eliminate the temptation to peer pressure to compare or compete with others. If we are happy for others when we find that they are blessed, instead of envious of others when they are blessed, we will be less inclined to be discontent with the things we have and want to change that and go into debt in order to do that. Honor God in His wisdom by living and practicing it long term. And what God has done when He created humankind, He created us quite malleable. He designed us to adjust to conditions. We can adjust to the changing, as Paul said, changing conditions of our financial lives. Learn to control thoughts and feelings. Solomon writes in Proverbs 21, 20 and 21, he who follows righteousness and mercy finds life, righteousness, and honor. So we discover that when we pursue righteousness in this matter and keep our focus on it and control our thinking about it rather than thinking about material things, then we discover that we get more than just spirituality. we get great spiritual blessings. Being wealthy or poor is not an indicator of righteousness. I know I'm moving quickly, but I would like to finish this in a timely way. Avoid the use of debt to satisfy desires. Absolutely. Absolutely. The Lord's point in Luke 12 and 15, beware of covetousness. That's the problem. Beware of covetousness or greed, as other translations render that passage. We are not made up, and our time in this world is not about possessions. In fact, I think in our culture we have replaced the word greed with need. If I want it, I need it. And therefore, it's not about greed. It's about things that I must have. And you see a great deal of crime committed over that. But we are also seeing persons engaging in a lot of personal debt in order to get what they think they need, but which is actually a form of greed. In personal debt, advertisers are the drug manufacturers. What they do is produce those things that suddenly become needs. Actually, what we are is greedy for those things, but we perceive them as needs, like the addict needs his drug in order to satisfy the desire of his body. So the advertisers are the drug manufacturers. They're the ones that generate this greed in our culture. And the greed takes over people. The credit card industry is the dealer. The credit card gives them the means whereby they can satisfy or think they can satisfy that need. They're the dealers. You know how the drug dealer sells the drugs to the addict and the addict takes the drug to satisfy that need? The credit industry is the dealer. And the media is the enabler. The media is the one that tells everybody you're okay doing that. It's fine. It's you know, that's just the world we live in. The media is what makes it okay for people, makes them feel good while they are going out and incurring debt. Yes?
I think our culture has gone even one step further and calling it not just a need, but you are entitled to this. That this is something that you are entitled. And if it hurts someone else, so be it. I'm entitled to that.
Yeah. Now, this is not a criticism, Sandy, but that word, entitlement, to me is cussing. I hate that word because it characterizes so many, not just moral departures, but departures from common sense and reasoning in our current world. Yes, that's a very good point. That the media is not just the enabler. They're the ones that are not telling people you're okay doing this. You're entitled to do this. You're entitled to have that brand new car. You're entitled to have the more expensive model of that car. You know, I don't need to sidetrack, but that's a good point. This is one of my favorite quotes by Francis of Assisi. I have a collection of them, but this is one of my favorite. And I'll explain why in just a moment. He writes, man has confessed to every sin except for greed. And that is just so on point. No one believes that they're greedy. Even the greedy people don't believe. The ones who are obviously greedy don't think that they're greedy. It's insane. When I was teaching about 25 years ago on the subject of local church discipline, I used the example of the Apostle Paul teaching about discipline in one text where he talks about covetous brother. I think it's the 1 Corinthians 5 text. He talks about if any brother is covetous, mark such a one, withdraw from him and so forth that he may be ashamed. And I asked the question in class, in the history of the church, have you ever heard of anyone being withdrawn from for covetousness? Why? Because no one thinks they're covetous. No one thinks they're greedy. And I think that this may be one of the factors that's going to make this extremely difficult for Christians to overcome the temptation toward indebtedness, let alone the rest of our world. A crash is going to happen before our world gets it. It is much easier to see greed in others than it is in ourselves. The next one, protect yourself from impulse purchases. I mean, put yourself in a place where you can't make the purchase. If you have a credit card and you're going out window shopping, leave the credit card at home. I know you carry them, we can carry them on our phones now. Leave them at home. That way we protect ourselves. There's many other little things that we can do, but I think the best way to do it is to get in control of ourselves by setting a budget and ask the question, is that part of the budget? And the answer is, if it doesn't fit into the budget, it's not something that we can get at this time. We can plan for it in the future. And a budget's nothing more than pre-made decisions. Guard against impatience. Raise your hand if you've seen the original Willy Wonka movie, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Okay. How many of you remember Baruka Salt? She's the little girl that was the spoiled rich girl, and she sang a song. Don't care how, I want it now. Okay. Well, you recognize that. And that's what's become, you know, natural about our culture. I think that that's part of the problem that we have with investors, but this is economics. This isn't a Bible class. This isn't Bible class material. But in economics, the reason why we don't see long-term investments anymore is people want short-term return. And so they invest for the short-term, never for the long-term. And that decreases the stability of the market. But anyway, when it comes to individuals making purchases, we need to be patient. Cultivate delayed gratification. Yes, one day, and I'll save for that. Or one day, perhaps circumstances will change and it will come my way. Instead of wanting it right now. Cultivating delayed gratification is the way we protect ourselves against impatient and impulsive purchases. This way we protect our savings plan. It changes our thinking about waiting to make purchases. And again, it's counterintuitive in a culture that says, I want it now and you should get it now. We need to draw lines in this matter about being patient financially. And if we don't draw the line, that line's going to be drawn for us by others. This one also seems a little counterintuitive. Give generously. I find in the scriptures that this is encouraged for everyone. And we often think, well, this needs to be said only to those who are affluent and financially stable. No, this is also said to those who are poor. Marvin Olasky, in his book, The Death of American Compassion, that was written about 25 years ago, made an excellent point. And his point was that in our country, when things are difficult, those who are the greatest contributors in terms of the percentage of their income are those who are middle class and lower in their income. As a percentage of income, give greater than say, corporations or businesses or the greatly affluent persons. We look at Bill Gates giving $1 million to something and we say, wow, that's a lot of money. Isn't he a great man? No, as a percentage of his income, it's pocket change. Set long-term goals for giving. Give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. So these five facts will facilitate our giving. First, that God owns it all. Second, that God is first when it comes to giving. Third, God doesn't need our money. But we need to be giving it to God. It is a need that we have, and we can afford to do it. These are facts, and all of these are Bible-based. Set some long-term goals with regard to financial matters, and this is something that the Lord taught, especially with regard to spirituality, and this again reinforces our original point. The original point was that economic or financial choices are based upon spiritual decisions. Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, lay up treasures in heaven. And so these six things are what we need to know about setting long-term goals financially. We can't take it with us, but we can send it on ahead. How we manage our money testifies about whether we believe what we say we believe. If we aim at nothing, we will hit it every time. And this speaks to the need to make plans and stick to them. Long-term rewards have no shortcuts, so we are patient with our plan and stick with it. The certainty of economic uncertainty, that we need to prepare for a future that may be uncertain. Good times do not last. And don't fall into the trap thinking that prosperity is the answer. It's not. Security in the Lord is the answer. Let me quickly go through this little story here, and then we'll bring the class to a close. An ancient Persian story is told about an unhappy king. In an attempt to find the answer to discontent, he consulted his magicians and astrologers, who told him he could find happiness by wearing the coat of a perfectly happy man. Immediately, the king set out on his quest to find a man who was perfectly happy, from whom he could buy his coat. He knocked on the doors of the very rich, for it seemed logical to him that he would find perfect happiness there, but it was in vain. He visited the institutions of higher learning, thinking the scholarly must be very happy in their wisdom. That, too, proved to be a dead end. He thought that he might find happiness among the young. No. Perhaps the beautiful. Not really. Weary with his disappointing search, he stumbled across a common laborer gleefully singing at his work of sweeping sand from the streets. When the king asked why he was singing, he confessed that he was perfectly happy with his work. "Sell me your coat," cried the king. "I'll give you a bag of gold for it." But the laborer only laughed again and said, "I'd gladly give it to you, sir, but you see, I have no coat." Happiness is not dependent upon things and stuff. Remember that great wealth is not synonymous with great joy. In 1 Timothy 6:6, godliness with contentment is great gain. And the fellow who wrote this is the same guy who says, "I know how to be in abundance, and I know how to be in want, and I've learned how to be content in both places." Whether one is wealthy or poor, find contentment in that place. Do not use debt as a means of looking for contentment or happiness either. Thank you for paying careful attention. Steve.
I love that point that you had to give generously. I can afford to give. It's sometimes I might think I can't afford it to give, but I think of the widow's mite. I think of the other type thing. I might have a mindset I can't afford it, but am I willing to sacrifice maybe a McDonald's meal this week to give? Or can I find another little way that I could maybe cut back on something? What's back to the spiritual thing first. What can I do to put back a little bit? And like David said, I'll sacrifice nothing that a sacrifice that costs me nothing. And so sometimes to sacrifice, it might hurt a little bit, but that's what the attitude is true giving.
And you see where that financial decision comes from, or that financial choice comes from, to make the sacrifice. It comes from a spiritual place. It comes from a spiritual decision that one has resolved, that like David had resolved to be a spiritually minded person and serve the Lord with all of his strength. And he realized that allowing someone else to pay for his offering was not a spiritual choice. And so he made the choice to pay the fellow for it, Arana, to pay him for that threshing floor and for the oxen and the implements, so that it would be a sacrifice on David's part. That's an excellent point. We may have to make decisions all the time, and our lives can change. But what we'll discover is that we can learn to find appreciation in the new circumstances. We can learn to find joy in the new condition. My friends up north tease me all the time. They tease me, "You live on a golf course and you don't play golf?" You know, there's kind of a... that was one of the most... the best recreation I could ever think of whenever I lived up in Pennsylvania and in Ohio. You know, that's what I did. I played golf. I've played only twice since I've come here, and don't feel the impulse to do so. It's changed. Now we do gardening, And we do gardening on a grand scale, and it's quite a challenge. The adjustment has been made. And that's what, that's kind of a trivial way of looking at it, but I'm trying to say is that we can make the changes and learn to find things to appreciate in whatever condition we find ourselves, whatever circumstances we find ourselves. Is the transition fun? No. Is it painful sometimes? Yes. But going into debt isn't the answer for it. Appreciate the comments and the questions in the class. That was quite a bit of material for us to cover.